we wanted to take a look at a few excerpts from Joe Paterno's chapter from his book, Paterno by the Book, chapter 4 on Virgil. You can find the book on Amazon. There are no copies currently in print, but there are plenty of used copies, and I'm sure you can find it in the Paterno Library.
I want to add, the reason we're reading this, or one of the reasons, as it says in that chapter, I believe I'm paraphrasing, but he says, no one can understand who I am or how I teach football if they don't understand my experience with Virgil that I had back in high school. And so tell us some of that, Tom. And I hope the listeners who are listening say, well, I don't want to stay on the air for a reading. You know, this is really a monument to Joe Paterno, and it is really worth hearing.
If destiny guided me anywhere, anytime during my 4 years at Brooklyn Prep, it was through the door of my Latin class on the first day of my third year. The teacher up front was a black-robed scholastic with a bony-cheeked, long, ascetic face atop the wiry body of a welterweight. And he looked over through his cool, glassy blue eyes. A stranger to us all, and probably hiding a quiver or two, he was an absolute rookie, facing the first meeting of the first class he had ever taught. Thomas Birmingham, Mr. Birmingham, as we addressed this future priest, moved the length of the blackboard and the width of the room slowly and serenely. He was 25. I was going on 17. For him, this was not only a first class, but the first day of a long period within the 13-year trek to becoming a Jesuit, called the Regency Period. Ahead of him lay 4 more years, equally locked away, all devoted to theology. But between those 2 periods, a seminarian is given a 3-year time of change. He gets to return to the world of people, reminding himself of the lives of others and taking responsibility and serving them as a teacher. He was in our classroom, suddenly sprung for us. He knew exactly where he wanted to bring us. I'm going to paraphrase here. Mr. Birmingham quizzed Joe Paterno and his classmates in what Joe calls the most puzzling darn quiz I had ever gotten. They were tasked with explaining their favorite books, and then they were going to be graded on their favorite books. And Paterno says he wonders how he can be graded on an opinion, but he was, and he got a B. A couple of days later, Paterno says, Father Birmingham asked me to see him after school. He got me talking about what interested me outside of classes, and I told him about my football, basketball, baseball, and that I was starting to think I'd have to drop baseball to focus properly on the other two. He got me to talk about my life, about election to class offices and the clubs I belonged and liked to, book discussion, sodality club, a religious discussion group that also gave us the opportunity to work in the neighborhood among the poor and whoever else we could serve. That's a lot of activity, he said. I'm not sure you'd have time for something else I have in mind. He paused, and I waited. I thought you and I might do up a list of further readings that we might get into together. Alarm flamed through my chest. I was scared that he was going to think me too busy and not give me the chance. I must have shown it. Would you be interested in my guiding you further along these lines? I couldn't blurt out yes fast enough. He goes on to say that Father Birmingham always developed these outside of normal classroom experiences, and that it was a fundamental part of the teaching experience. I can't help but notice, by the way, how bizarre a reaction it seems to a contemporary reader to think that he was bursting to say, yes, I want more education from the teacher. Isn't that bizarre?
I would like to also point out as you read this how almost impossible it would be to do that today. You couldn't meet with a student. An older person couldn't meet with a student without the door open or someone else in the room. You know, but then we trusted people and we had faith in people, and so many things were possible. And an experience like this, it's horrible that these sexual predators have gotten in the news, and they're very far and few. You know, that young people need the experience of older people helping to guide them, and that's what's taking place that Joe's kind of talking about here.
At the beginning of my senior year, this austere big brother of a priest-to-be led me to Virgil. Father Birmingham told me that Virgil was the greatest of the Roman poets, that he lived just 3 or 4 decades before Christ, and that he is known mostly for his epic poem, The Aeneid. Father Birmingham asked if I'd like to read it with him. Sure, I said. What I had in mind, said Father Birmingham, is reading it together in the original Latin. In Latin, Paterno asked, a poem as long as a book. Yes, said Father Birmingham. The book was on his desk, more than 400 pages thick. As a school kid, I always had the attitude about any challenge, hey, if it's difficult, let's do it. That made it more fun. But if it's in Latin, I asked uncertainly, will we be able to cover all that? What's important, Father Birmingham said, is not how much we cover. I don't like that word, cover. It's not how much we do, but the excellence of what we do. Excellence. The way he pronounced that word made it shine with a golden light. I'll never forget the majestic ring of the opening lines and of how we approximated them in modern English. Of arms and the man I sing. It made me hear cymbals and trumpets, and I envisioned a procession of gallant gladiators. At their head, on a huge horse, rode the most gallant of all, a king or a prince of some kind of or some kind of general. It rang in my ears again, of arms and the man I sing. And then, from the seacoast of Troy in the early days, he came to Italy by destiny. I still feel the spell of that young robed cleric's eyes searing into me, reminding me that I was special and that this was important. He never talked down. Instead of telling me his thoughts, he'd pull them out of me. He'd ask, why do you think he used that word? I'd think about it and developed feelings not only for the precision of words, but also for the subtle shadings of those words in Latin. So Virgil and his hero Aeneas, the founder of Rome, entered my life, more than entered it. The adventures of Aeneas seeped into far corners of my mind, into my feelings about what is true and honorable and important. They helped shape everything I have since become. I don't think anybody can get a handle on what makes me tick as a person, and certainly can't get at the roots of how I coach football without understanding what I learned from the deep relationship I formed with Virgil during those afternoons and later in my life. The story of Aeneas tells how the city of Rome was founded. By birth, Aeneas is a Trojan, the son of the goddess of love, Venus. As Troy is ransacked and conquered through trickery by the Greeks, Aeneas gathers up an army of survivors and leads them to an escape by sea. In a scene of his leaving Troy, Aeneas lifts his aging father on his back and grasps the hand of his little son, who runs along by his side. He was physically carrying, protecting, preserving the past, one could say, and in the same act, taking care of those who would live into the future. That, I decided Virgil was trying to say, was the duty of a responsible man, a leader.
And the meaning of a university, by the way.
If you're just tuning in here on the Line 90.7 FM, this is a special pregame edition of Radio Free Penn State. We're reading from Joe Paterno's 1985 autobiography, co-authored with Bernie Asbell, called Paterno by the Book. This is chapter 4 on Virgil, which Paterno cites as the most profound impact on the way he coached football and the way he lived his life. And so we're reading this in honor of Joe and to understand the man who we've glorified and made into a hero, and in some ways, as a result, can seem distant to us. Continuing, the poem actually begins at a later moment in his story. At a climax of Aeneas' sea journey, the world crashing around him in a catastrophic storm. His fleet splits apart and some of his shattered ships and men sinking, smashing into rocks and shore. Instead of his own ship landing where the Fata, the Fates, had promised him was his goal, on the shores of what we now call Italy, he finds himself stranded on the jungle shores of Africa, losing even more of his men. I've been deceived, he cries. He's ready to give up, craves to get out of this mission and its terror and suffering. But he knows that his destiny, through the Fata, have commanded him to get himself and the tatters of his army to Italy to start a new city, Rome. He's exhausted, discouraged. Aeneas has to go through a great struggle with himself to renew any kind of faith in the Fata, in the voices of his destiny. That puzzled and bothered me. If he knew he wanted to quit, how did he know he had to go on? If he lost faith in the Fata, how did he know what his destiny was? So Father Birmingham had to explain some confusion over the modern meaning of the word fate. Today we think of fate the way the Greeks meant it. Something that just happens and takes control of your life. Something meted out to you. The piece of pie you were handed. It's not something you choose. Among the Greek storytellers, especially Homer, heroes like Odysseus and Achilles are batted around constantly by predetermined accidents and obstacles they couldn't foresee and can't do a thing about. But the word fatum in Latin means something different. It means a divine word. All through the Aeneid, Aeneas gets the messages from Jupiter, the supreme god, through Mercury or others whose voices he hears in his head. They keep saying, you ought to do this. You've got to do that. Today, people talk about a voice within, or intuition, or a strong feeling. Maybe they're saying the same thing. Virgil keeps harping that Aeneas, that anybody, needs to have faith and trust in that fatum. If they confuse, it may bewilder, it may contradict and frustrate all of a guy's most precious urges. It sure as hell may seem illogical, but a fatum cannot be denied.
Let me play the role of Father Birmingham here and suggest some meaning to what you've just read. The Greek idea of fate is something that just happens, that horribly crashes around you. And here at Penn State, we have just had an act of fate, something horribly come and crash around us. And then he reverts to the Latin idea of fate, the Roman idea, which is a destiny. And this is something that guides you in the midst of the catastrophe. And that catastrophe, his homeland, Troy, had been destroyed. He leaves it by sea, and destiny leads him to find, says to him, you must, in place of Troy, which has been destroyed, build a new nation, build a new city that will become the mistress of the world. And so he's at once undergoing this horrible fate that has befallen them, and at the same time listening to the voice of destiny that says, go and build something greater. Well, that's exactly the circumstances that we find ourselves in at Penn State today.
Skipping ahead, we get to on a few pages ahead. In some of the passages that touch me the deepest, Virgil looks straight into the heart of Aeneas. In the opening storm at sea, he figures everything he risked his life to save in leaving Troy is now lost. His mission seems impossible, and he feels helpless and overwhelmed. He goes off by himself to tremble and cry like a kid. Then, somehow, he pulls himself together, knowing even in his agony that he can't spill his guts to the men he has to lead. Destiny has stuck him with being a leader, and he cannot escape it. The bravery, the picking up and going on, affected me, sure. But what got to me most in that scene was that Aeneas, the son of a god driven by fates, was, after all, a human being. His secret places were like mine. He might have had to put up a bold front as a leader, but he didn't have to hide his sadness and trembling from himself. There was one more important thing that Father Birmingham led me to see in Virgil, and it made the deepest mark of all on the way that I coach. Almost everybody who's been to high school knows about Homer and his two epics, the Odyssey and the Iliad. Teachers often draw parallels between Virgil and Homer because of the epics of heroes seem to have a lot in common. Of course, Homer was Greek and Virgil Roman. Homer was dead for 700 years before Virgil learned his alphabet. But there's a more important difference between them, which teachers don't always see, that helped shape my outlook on life and on football. To Homer, and in fact to most of the modern world, heroes are created through personal exploits and glorification, often through an ambitious drive for self-glorification. Heroes are superstars. In sports, their grandstands cheer them. They throw high fives up and slam the football down after a touchdown. Homer's hero, Achilles, in his pursuit of glory, ends up destroying his men and his cause and rotting at the end into a kind of monster. Aeneas, as Virgil created him, was a totally new kind of epic hero. Like Homer's heroes, he endures battles, storms, shipwrecks, and the rages of the gods. But the worst storm is the one that rages within himself. He yearns to be free of his tormenting duty, but he knows that his duty is to others, to his men. Through years of hardship and peril, Aeneas reluctantly but relentlessly heeds his fata until he founds Rome. Aeneas is not a grandstanding superstar. He is, above all, a Roman and a Trojan. His first commitment is not to himself but to others. He is bugged constantly by the reminder, the fatum, you must be a man for others. He lives his life not for me and I, but for us and we. Aeneas is the ultimate team man. A hero of Aeneas' kind does not wear his name on the back of his uniform. He doesn't wear Nittany Lions on his helmet to claim star credit for touchdowns and tackles that were enabled by everybody doing his job. For Aeneas' kind of hero, the score belongs to the team.
At this point, those words strike me as applying most to Mike McQuarrie, who was loyal to his friends and to his people in that, in all this situation, has told the truth. The grand jury said he was extremely credible. Strange a high compliment for a grand jury to say in a thing. And Mike McCreary is now being hounded by the press, as Aeneas is in hounded by the storms and the destruction of Troy. And he can't even come to the game, and he has to have protection. But, you know, he responded to the cares about the people that he knew. And he then, you know, realized he had to do something and went to the coaches and went to do something about it. And I see, you know, the self-doubt, the ties, all the ties pulling on him, that the Aeneas, from that description, is Mike McQuarrie, as well as Joe Paterno, as he said, "I wish I had done more." You know, he admits it all and realizes there were many ties pulling on them in the storms of fate. And through this, have proved themselves to be real men.
The very last segment here at the end of the chapter. "Father Birmingham didn't have to lecture me on most of that. We were just reading sentence by sentence in Latin, and there it was, a living experience. Once a person has experienced a genuine masterpiece, the size and scope of it last as a memory forever."
And that was once the meaning of college education, to have that experience that lasted forever.
Nothing less than masterpieces.
Right. And Joab Thomas gave a talk to the Board of Trustees in the early 90s, pointing out that for almost every one of our curricula in science and business and so forth, they had their maximum value upon graduation to get your first job, and they declined in value every year after that as that what they learned became obsolete. Everything was moving fast, so fast in business and science and in engineering and so forth. Every one of our curricula, it was moving so fast that almost everything you learned was obsolete 5 years after you graduated. But what Joe is pointing out in the original idea of an education, to experience the masterpieces in college, you know, those experiences grow in value with every year of your life.